Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey. Hey everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. Today we are traveling to 1991 to discuss the film The Fisher King, directed by Terran Gilliam, starring Robin Williams, Jeff Bridges, Mercedes Rule, and Amanda Plummer.
So how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
So far, so good. I was really excited about this movie when I saw it was coming up on the list.
So Dad, why did you pick this film?
So I picked this film for a couple different reasons. One, it was originally slated for season one, but we were doing so many serious movies in a row that we decided to switch it out for a less serious film. I think it was Hopscotch or one of those other ones. But we kept it on the list, and we kept on pushing it back, and eventually just season one ended. And because the subject matter does deal with suicidal thoughts, a mass murder in a restaurant, and mental health, we were trying to find a way how to discuss this and really kind of talk about the performances of Robin Williams, Jeff Bridges, Mercedes Rule, the direction of Terry Gilliam. So we finally decided that we were going to put it as episode 6 in this season. It's very interesting to people's reaction to this film too. I've had friends who totally don't like this film. Friends who really like this film. It's like one of their favorites. It's like one of their favorite Terry Gilliam films or one of their favorite Robin Williams films. And so it's all over the board on where people fall in this film. And I think it's because it's a blend of comedy, drama, and fantasy. And the fantastical elements either pull you in deeper into the story because they're able to discuss parts of the story in a metaphorical way that it's easier to digest and see the emotions and the effects on people than maybe a straight drama would. And some people get turned off by that. They don't like fantasy elements in their films. What?
No, when you said that, when we were doing research for this movie, we went and saw Roger Ebert talking about, I knew his name, but the minute that I had to say it, I was like, bloop, bloop, bloop. But Roger Ebert and his review of the movie, and he said something like, I wish there was less fantastical elements in this movie. And I was just like, do you even understand what movie you're watching? It's
well, yeah, I think the thing is that he never was a huge fan of Terry Gilliam.
No,
pretty much every movie that Terry Gilliam put out, he didn't.
Well,
but that's his taste. It's
well, Terry Gilliam is definitely like a, you know, blueberry bubblegum type person. You either love it or you hate it. It's never in between, you know? And so, yeah. And so I understand that not liking a certain director, but I also have to, as a person who is a critic, should take out their biases against the director and try to actually focus on the elements of the story, because without the fantastical elements dragging you into the story deeper, the movie does not work because the fantastical elements.
Fantastical?
Sorry, fantastical elements are the representation of Robin Williams' character's mental illness. And so without, you know, the Red Knight and the noises and the things like that, we don't see.
Yeah, it was a visual way of letting you into the world of that character, how that character perceived the world.
And I thought it was a very interesting way, because usually when people try to show that, you know, this is their inside their mind, they usually do like this weird like fishbowl filter where it's like really clear in the middle and really foggy on the outside.
Yeah, they try to use like lens work, yeah, and camera work to describe it, and to be straightforward, the the camera does shift and the camera and the cinematography does flip back and forth between the fantastical world in Robin Williams' mind and the regular world, but it's not as drastic, and it's mostly about where the camera is staged, how it's looking at the world, and things like that. So another thing too, I thought was very interesting, bringing up the Roger Ebert's review. Once Robin Williams passed, they went back and they RogerEbert.com did a reevaluation of the film, and they reassessed it, and they gave it a much better, a much more favorable review, and I think that would have happened. I think that wasn't just because Robin Williams passed. I think it's because they kind of caught up to the movie.
We understand what the movie is going for now, especially since there's a lot of independent movies now that are kind of dealing with this like fantastical energies within the real world.
Well, Terry Gilliam always had kind of that magic realism intertwined in his film, and his universes were always these askew looks at the world. Like, it's the world, you can see our world in it, sort of, and then you can see it's definitely a version of the world that's askew, like Time Bandits, Brazil. He also did Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. He did 12 Monkeys. He's done a lot of films that definitely are different looks into our world and have a fantastical element to it, and also have either he uses science fiction, or in this case he uses more of that mythic epic poetry, the Fisher King, to tell the story. So I enjoy his stuff, because it does make me think, and afterwards my brain is going, oh yeah, and I'm like processing the film, and it gives me something to think about later on in the week. As some of the critics said, they don't like movies that are so overstuffed. And okay, that's their prerogative. But as we can tell, it's become a cult classic.
Speaking of Terry Gilliam, this was kind of like a comeback for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a comeback. It's kind of weird because if you look at his like movie, the movies he made, there doesn't seem to be like this big gap at that time in his career. But the movie he had made before this was The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which was a very difficult movie to get made. And it wasn't the movie that it didn't end up being the movie he wanted.
Yeah, because, you know, people who put money into films like to monkey around with the pieces. And
well, there's two things I think. I think, well, number one, the movie that he wanted to make was larger than the money that he was given. And there was a lot of completion bonds that were made for that movie. So the way that the people kind of view that movie as it was over budget, it took too long to film, and that he was totally out of control. And that's what the people with the money are going to say. But they also gave him the money to make the film. So,
Are you really out of control?
Yeah. And number one, number two, he ended up cutting like major parts of the story and major special effects pieces and sequences that never got made. And in fact, the one scene that actually was the scene that made him want to make the movie, and he wrote it the first scene, and it's a famous scene where Baron Munchausen is riding a horse that's in half, like it's only the front half of the horse, never got filmed. And that was the film. That was the scene that he just had this great, it would be a great vision to see this person. And so... when he got done with the film, he was just completely drained and it was completely like kind of bitter because people were making promises and then later on they reneged and all this other stuff. So he wasn't very popular. He thought his career was going to be pretty much over. The movie bombed. So bombed in the financial way, but there was people who really enjoyed it. In fact, it's still considered in a musical frame reference, it's still considered kind of like the hidden gem album of a band that only the diehard fans know about in his movie log. So it's just one of the things that I really enjoy. The film is fun to watch. It's a little scattered, but it's a great adventure story. And so he thought his career was over. And so the next thing he was looking at, he didn't want anything with major special effects. He didn't want anything with history or in the future or in dystopian. He wanted a pretty straightforward film. And when this movie landed in his lap, at first he wasn't really interested in it. But then
it's another Grail movie.
Yeah, because it was another Grail movie.
The Grail is a major plot reference throughout the whole of the movie. And so I can understand, as a person who doesn't want to be like tied down to stuff, you know, especially since he's trying to make his name outside of Monty Python, going, you know, it's kind of like playing the biggest hits, you know.
Terry Gilliam and Terry Jones directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Mostly Terry Jones set up things and Terry Gilliam made sure that things were happening, and because Terry Jones was also a lot of times in the scene and vice versa. So Terry Gilliam had minor parts in it. But also the thing, you have to think about this too, it's considered a classic film. You have Monty Python and the Holy Grail is considered by this time in 91 a classic. Why would you want to redo a movie with the Grail as a major plot point? And two, you're going up against your own work, which is pretty darn good. It was kind of a slightly different take on it. And he was able to see that, it's more of a character-driven study of these people. And he loved the idea of creating a modern epic adventure in New York. And he felt that New York was the perfect place for these adventures, because you could film New York like under bridges and on the side of buildings, and it would seem like medieval. It would have like the resonance of medieval Europe through the shots and stuff like that. So he really had fun setting that up. And he was kind of brought in also.
Or at least, sorry.
What?
I was going to say something, it doesn't matter.
No, say it.
I was going to say, or at least what he says in his documentaries about this movie.
Well, he's been asked multiple times about this film, and I've read some articles, and you can read some of the articles from the late 90s, early 2000s to now, and you can see the refining of the story that he tells people. But the basic parts always stay the same, so that's why I kind of feel like this is kind of essentially what happened. They wanted Robin Williams to be in the movie, and he was kind of interested. And because he had the one thing that good thing that came out of The Adventures of Baron Munchausen is he worked with Robin Williams in that film, and they had a really good working relationship. And so when the two producers, Deborah Hill and Linda Obst, went to Robin Williams, they were able to say, hey, we have Terry Gilliam on board. And that made Robin Williams much more interested in the film. There seems to be little slight variations of that story, but basically Terry Gilliam was a hook for Robin Williams, and Robin Williams was really excited to work with him again. And then one of my favorite Jeff Bridges films, The Fabulous Baker Boys, that he filmed with his own brother, Bo Bridges and Michelle Pfeiffer, when Terry Gilliam was flying across the country, he watched it on the plane and he goes, that's the guy. Jeff Bridges is the guy I want to play the shock jock. And they had other actors in mind, and he kept on pushing, and he went and tried to convince Jeff Bridges to be in it. And Jeff Bridges famously says, I tried to give him all my friends' names. But Jeff Bridges is also one of those guys you have to convince to be in your film. He convinced Jeff Bridges to be in it because he saw in The Fabulous Baker Boys, if you watch that movie, there is kind of a darkness. He's kind of the darker of the two brothers in that film. And so he was like, oh, that's the guy I want to play the shock jock that's going to instigate this whole thing. And Jeff Bridges' character has to be a shock jock without morals, who eventually, by the end of the movie, has morals. And I think that that transition is amazing. He sets up the instigating incident so well because a guy calls into his radio show, tells him that he really likes this person that works at this restaurant, and Jeff Bridges, just being, you know, a shock jock DJ, starts yelling at him and says, oh no, all those yuppies at this restaurant need to die, and all this other stuff. And he just keeps telling them that they're the worst parts of humanity. And then later that night, of course, that person goes in and shoots people in and kills people at the restaurant, one of them being Robin Williams' wife, which sends him on this adventure. So all this stuff happens within the first 15 minutes, so I don't feel like I'm giving away anything at this point. Jeff Bridges at this time hadn't really played somebody that would truly had a dark side like this. And Robin Williams hadn't been as serious.
No, 1 hour photo has not come out yet, so he has not been serious.
There was a lot of film. Well, he was being more of an actor at this point, but there was definitely more comedy in him. And I think this role really stretched him. I don't know. What do you think?
I've seen a lot of his other stuff that he's like I mentioned 1 hour photo, and I really enjoyed that movie because of the fact that Robin Williams is creepy as heck. He's a stalker. He looks like if Robin Williams was trying to dress up as Anderson Cooper for Halloween. So that's just kind of crazy on its own. But the whole story about how do you really know the people who help you and things like that. A really creepy film on its own. And I definitely could see how this type of movie could influence 1 hour photo in the sense of it's both comedy, which Robin Williams is known to be really good at, but also has this darker elements of drama and tragedy that I think he plays very well.
Yeah.
But he doesn't go too far on both ends of the scale. So when he does do the major switches, it doesn't feel jarring.
No, it felt like a complete performance and a complete characterization. It didn't feel like he was, like you said, like swinging wildly from one to the other, which I think would have made the character of Perry, the person he plays, seem unrealistic. You know, because somebody who swings so wildly would on film play like, we don't know where this character's going, so therefore we would, as an audience, would go, I don't understand where this character's going. And I mean, they do subtle things like Perry his real name is not Perry, but he plays a person named Perry who, once he comes out of the mental institution, that's who he says he is. And Perry, of course, is short for Parsifal, who's one of the knights who goes and looks for the
Holy Grail.
Holy Grail. But they don't sit there and
they don't baby feed you.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's one of the things I really like about Terry Gilliam's movies and movies like this in general is that they are heavy and they are multi-layered, but they're not peeling back the layers and going, look at how many layers we have. Aren't we awesome? You know, they let you take it at face value. They also let you could do a lot more. And also, I think this movie, because of the fact that they don't go, hey, look at all this amazing stuff that we do, each rewatch, you find and you see new things.
So it was really funny because I had a really serious conversation with one of my friends years ago, speaking of not being spoon-fed things. Like, the Red Knight comes running. It's a really gorgeous costume. And it has...
which I can tell you a little bit about because I did research on it because the costume.
Yeah, it is really cool. And it's pretty amazing costume. But it has this look of it. It kind of has almost like a somewhat samurai-ish look to it with like these like flags and things coming off of it. Like, what's the word I'm looking for? I can't remember, but it has this, like, this really... And my friend is convinced the reason that the knight looks like that, or he was convinced, was the reason the knight looks like that is because it mimics a shotgun blast, when it hits somebody. So like when it's riding towards him, that's what he is seeing. And I was like, I think that's an interesting interpretation. Yeah, I can totally see that. And it's never spoon-fed to you. It's never told you that's why the Red Knight looks like this. And it probably was designed that way for that. Or it could have been designed intentionally because of that. It wanted to make it look like a shotgun blast coming at you because that's what kills his wife. So.
Yeah, costume's very interesting. It was, if I remember correctly, about 200 pounds. There was tanks of gas inside the saddle on the horse. It was lined with ice packs, which we see a lot of, like, interviews now with, like, the superheroes going, like, we had coolant running in through our costumes because it was so heavy, and it's kind of like the 90s version of that, yeah. You know? You know, everything was padded, so if the stunt person fell off, you know, they wouldn't die. Well, I think, and it was also those little flaggy things that you were talking about, the where I was reading, they're made out of fishing hooks, fishing poles.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of really interesting if you think about it because it's a wonderful design, but it's also practical use and things like that because fishing poles isn't heavy, you know, and it's already so much. Wait.
Well, one of the things that they were really worried about was the horse getting scared and knocking the rider off because the rider on the back of his... On the fire that came out of the back of him went up or something like that, there was a tank on his back. And if he got knocked off the horse and landed on his back, it would have exploded and would have killed him. So they were really stressed out about the horse not getting freaked out. And this horse was a show horse and trained for stunts. The horse worked on a Big Top Pee Wee and other movies with big stunts, so it wasn't like the horse freaked out. And the horse, from all stories, handled it just fine, even though we would probably freak out with all that much fire. But the horse has been trained to deal with that kind of stuff. And there's stories of people, when they're doing it, the police having to go talk to people about not scaring the horse, because that was causing more issues than the actual setup.
The fire. Well, I also read that he could control the fire via, like, a button on the jousting stick, but that could also be just, you know, people.
Yeah, no, there's definitely, there's a documentary with the guys who designed the suit and everything that you can find. I think it's part of the Criterion disc set. I think it's also... I think somebody uploaded it to YouTube. So if you really want to know more about the costume, it's a fascinating study because they didn't have a plan for that costume, which is a central part of the movie, until almost up until shooting. They really didn't know how it was going to go. And when it finally came out, everybody was amazed. One thing that they did do, they never thought about this, is that they're running this horse through New York City. And so they were just, when they were practicing it, they were doing it, like, on fields and stuff like that. And the New York City police farrier who puts the shoes on the New York City police horses came back and showed them how to do it with little rubber grips on the bottom of the shoes so the horse wouldn't slip and slide around. So, yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
That is pretty fascinating. I also think that a lot of people should just go back and watch this movie for the costumes too, because it's a really great example of how to make modern clothing, how to design modern clothing to fit a purpose. Because usually when people watch movies where it's like kind of, in the 90s, but we'll call it modern times, like any movies that are like supposed to be...
That is technically still modern times.
You know what? Before I go on, I read somewhere it says that the 1990 is just right. It's just as far away as 2050 is. Like, we're right in the middle between those two, and that just kind of blew my mind a little. But one of the things that I think is really good example of this movie is because a lot of people, when you watch movies that are set in quote unquote present day, you know, you could, you know, put jeans and t-shirts on, and, you know, it's their modern day clothes. But I think this is, but sometimes clothes do tell a story. Not sometimes, all the time. They do tell a story. And I think this movie is a really good example about, you know, they're all wearing modern clothes, but Perry's character definitely has a medieval squire look to him. And the band of homeless people also have this kind of medieval squire adventurer look to them. And so does Jeff Bridges' character.
Jeff Bridges' character has a couple different looks. He has the sleek look of when he's famous as the Shock Jock at the beginning. And then he goes back to that look. And it's very sleek. And I want to say shark-like, because it's a lot of dark grays and blacks, and it's very slick, and his hair is slicked back, and it just gives him that kind of that look. When he's in between those two points and he's living with Mercedes Rule, by the way, who does gives one of the best performances in a Terry Gilliam film. It's just an amazing film.
I think she won the Oscar for it.
Yeah, she got the Oscar for this, for Best Supporting Actress Oscar for this role. And when he's in with her and his life is up in the air and he's trying to figure out where he's at, if you notice, his clothes don't fit well. They're baggy, or they're not on him quite right. And so it's like, yeah, the clothes are telling you the story of what he is going through as a character, and they're underlying certain parts.
And I think one of the interesting things about this movie, and our DVD, the cover is Perry in the white suit.
Yes.
And I thought the white suit was a very interesting choice to put Perry in, especially for where Perry is in the middle during this part of the movie, especially since it doesn't fit him very well. Also for the fact that Whiteland suits kind of feel out of place, especially in an urban setting.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a very interesting, choice, to spotlight the Perry in the white suit on the cover, but also putting him there, especially since this is like his best he's ever been in this movie, and then it immediately gets taken away from him the second that the thing is over. So I thought it was just, a very interesting costuming choice.
I also felt like the actors who played a lot of the characters in the film, like Michael Jeter and Tom Waits and some of the other actors spread throughout the film, did a really good job of really inhabiting their characters and making the film feel like these were real people, not like people that were, okay, you're playing this person now. I mean, Michael Jeter's part as the homeless cabaret singer, I mean, it's an amazing part. And it's one of the things that I always, whenever I see him in other movies and TV shows, again, now that he's passed and I go back and I watch these movies, I always look at him and go, oh my God, that role for me defines him. And so I
sure it's not Mr. Noodle's brother, Mr. Noodle Sesame Street.
I mean, even like when he was one of the last movies he was in was Open Range. And when he was in that movie, I was like, he was such a good character actor. It took me like a moment to realize that's who he was. Like I said, and then Amanda Plummer as the object of Robin Williams' affection, she was really good about playing this person who you could both see as this ideal medieval love interest from afar. And then when you got to see her up close, all the quirks and all the different things that were really great. And again, another costuming thing where her costumes really do tell a story. She has an idealized costume that really would slide back into medieval prints, and the flow and stuff of her costumes are very similar to that. So
I also thought it was really interesting that though her costumes could fit, you know, definitely do have a medieval feeling to them, they definitely had a 60s vibe to them, which kind of also told the story of like how she's kind of out of
place.
Out of place as well. I think those types of costuming, especially in a modern setting, is one of the reasons why I really like costumes.
Yes.
You know, I have a really hard time with, like, with, you know, modern movies that just put actors in jeans and t-shirts and are like, costume design. It's like, no, you can put effort in and
well, it depends on what the film is.
Well, yes, but you know what I'm trying to say, you know.
Yeah, sometimes a jean and a t-shirt says a lot. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it's what the person wore to the set that day and that's what they were filmed in.
Yes. This movie is very interesting on many levels, but one of the reasons why I also found this very interesting is because this is one of the first movies, it's actually, I think it is the first movie that Terry Gilliam didn't write.
Yes, he did not write. He also, it's the first film that didn't have a cameo from somebody from Monty Python in. Very minimal special effects. That's one of the things that he was very insistent on, was that the effects and everything was in camera, because so many of the things that he wanted to do in Baron Munchausen were going to be special effects shot later, that they were very easy for people to cross off, and he didn't get to do, so he was like insistent on this one.
He got burned before, so he's not going to be burned again, yeah. You know?
So he shot it. So the everything is in camera. So it also fits the film better, I think.
This movie, speaking of which, because he didn't write it, you're probably wondering who wrote it, was written by Richard, I'm going to say his last name wrong, Gravenese. I've always read his name on paper, so I never understood.
Yeah, this was his first screenplay, which is amazing because you think of how deep this screenplay is and how many things it's dealing with. And he wrote this because he was writing with another writing partner, but he wanted to write a screenplay to show his style and his writing style so he could get a job. So he wrote this more as a spec script to get a job than actually having this film made of his, but it fell into the hands of Linda Obst and Deborah Hill, who were two producers that were working in Disney at the time. And then they went to TriStar and they took the movie with them. Katzenberg put it in turnaround so they could take it with them.
Or something like that. But it could have been a completely different movie if Disney decided to...
Well, Disney loved it, but they realized they were never going to make it.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't a Disney movie. It wasn't even a Touchstone film.
No, yeah. And especially since they talk about, you know, homelessness, you know, gun violence, mental illness... They can't Pretty Woman this movie, you know?
Like they did Pretty Woman?
Like they did with Pretty Woman.
Well, one of the things, too, I thought was very interesting. Halfway towards the end of the movie, there's a scene with John DeLancey, who's probably the best known for playing Q on Star Trek. And he plays a TV executive who's trying to get Jeff Bridges to come back and act in a sitcom about homelessness. And this is with three homeless people. And this is after... Jeff Bridges had all the interactions with Robin Williams and had actually lived with homeless people and dealt with homeless people in this movie. And the guy is pitching the story like, no, the homeless people like being homeless. They want to, it's an adventure. They want to live under outdoors. And I started to think, I always think about that scene. That's what Disney would be doing to this film right now if they had taken.
They'd be singing and dancing about how life in the street is amazing, you know. And
yes. So I always, in my the little headcanon in my thing is that's what Disney would be doing to this film right now if they had kept it.
Yes.
So anyway.
Yeah. And it's so weird too, because this movie was written by a person who's made three of my least favorite films of all time, which is P.S. I Love You, Freedom Writers, which we can get into in a different time, and, oh my God, which one did he make? I have a lot of movies that I hate.
You don't hate, you just like a lot.
Beautiful Creatures.
Well, that's the adaptation you didn't like, but he also wrote and directed that one, so you don't like him twice for that movie.
Yeah. That movie was very hard to get into, especially after reading the books. But
yeah, you weren't very happy with the adaptation.
No, but yeah, it's very interesting because he's also written so many other really good movies.
Well, you can't hit...
You can't hit it out of the park every time, but it just kind of makes me laugh because I, you know, you keep your mental list, and these are actual movies that are on the list, you know?
Yeah. Well, but for a first screenplay, it's pretty amazing. In fact, that it was produced by Linda Obst and Deborah Hill. So Deborah Hill, of course, is for me, she produced some of my favorite films because she was a producing partner with John Carpenter when he got started. So she did like Halloween and The Thing. And I know you're going to laugh because I'm not a huge horror fan.
No, you're not.
Horror film fan. But I'm a huge John Carpenter fan because of Escape from New York. I get another movie. And so I went back and I watched The Thing and watched Halloween. I'm not a huge fan of Halloween, but I love The Thing. I love the original one that he, well, as if it's the original, even though it's a remake of a 1950s.
Yeah, film. But his is the one that also got the remake too. So it's kind of like The Star is Born, you know, it's like.
But there's a definitive version of The Thing, and I think most people point to his as a definitive version of The Thing.
Yeah.
And so. She produced a lot of those films, and then she started becoming a producing partner with Linda Obst because I think Disney didn't know what to do with them, and so they stuck them together.
I find their stories very interesting because she's definitely, Deborah Hill is definitely viewed as this working woman.
Yeah.
You know, and of course the little feminist in me is going like, every working woman in the 80s deserves a high five, you know?
Yeah. I mean, she passed away because of cancer. I think it would have been interesting to follow her career, where her trajectory was going at that time. And Linda Obst has done some great producing and championed some great films that we wouldn't have seen.
Yeah.
Without her. And this is one of them. She's the one that found the script. She's the one that said this has to be made.
And she fought for it to be exactly how it was written.
Yeah. And she also was the one that brought Terry Gilliam on, and she had to smooth that over with TriStar Pictures because people have to remember that TriStar at that point was owned or partly owned by Columbia, and Columbia was the people that made Baron Munchausen, and they were kind of over Terry Gilliam, so she had to smooth that over a lot to get Terry Gilliam to direct the film. Watch this film, and you can't imagine anybody but Terry Gilliam directing it. And as a comeback film, something that show you that, yes, I can do a more straightforward film. I can do a film that has to do with relationships and that the performances are really important. The four main characters of Jeff Bridges, Mercedes Rule, Amanda Plummer, and Robin Williams are really well directed through that film. You feel like he was really focused on the performances. So when he did add in those extra elements, they worked together.
Did you notice that when Jeff Bridges was scaling the building, he walked in, he bumped into a window, and the window was the red knight? I thought that was so interesting. I was like, Because also, fun fact, the school that Robin Williams' character before his tragedy happened, later on bought the building
that
was filmed on. So I thought it was really interesting.
The armory,
yeah. Because it's a mansion in the movie, but it's an armory / school in real life. And the thing that I think was really interesting is that it totally shows how the brain works, because Robin Williams' character was a professor of medieval history focusing on the Holy Grail story.
And who was the Fisher King in the movie?
I want to say the Fisher King in the movie is Jeff Bridges' character.
See, I always follow the old man. The billionaire, the house they break into, who, because in the Fisher King story, the fool breaks into it, walks into his castle, which is what Jeff Bridges does,
mm-hmm.
and the old king who needs to be healed asks for a drink of water, so he goes and grabs the the Holy Grail, which was always there.
Well, it was a cup, and then it turned out to
be the Holy Grail. But it's always there, and the old king never saw it as the Grail, and he gives him the Holy Grail, just a sip of the water, and it heals him. And in this movie, Jeff Bridges, the fool, breaks into the castle to steal the Holy Grail that Robin Williams' character Perry thinks is there, because he sees this man, this billionaire, in a picture in a magazine, and with this cup behind him in the magazine, and that's, he's convinced that's the Holy Grail. So he goes and grabs, so Jeff Bridges goes to steal this for him to heal Robin Williams, this character's mentally. He breaks in, and there's, as he's stealing the Grail, or what he perceives to be the Grail, the old man is sitting in a chair by the fireplace, and he, quote unquote, accidentally has taken an overdose of pills, as how it's reported in the newspaper the next day. But it's obviously a suicide attempt. It's somebody who's very unhappy with his life, very unhappy with what's going on. And the fool purposely sets off the alarm so the fire, the police and the rescue come and save his life. So it's like, for me, the Fisher King is mirrored in the actual story.
That's what I was trying to say, and now I realize what question you asked and what question I answered.
Okay.
I think the fool is Jeff Bridges' character.
Yeah.
I do think the king is Robin Williams' character. Well, I think also this movie has a lot of layers that I think both of them switch roles.
Yeah.
So I think it's really hard to answer that question indefinite.
But I've always kind of felt like the older man, the billionaire who would be considered a king in our society because he's a multi-billionaire and owns half of the United States, would be considered the king.
Yeah, he would be. And
he lives in the castle, the armory. So this looks like a castle. And then when Robin Williams breaks in, he's obviously the fool.
Not the Robin Williams, Jeff Bridges.
Breaks in. He's obviously the fool. And the way that his actions lead to him being saved. And so I think that's, it mirrors the Fisher King.
Well, I think also, yeah, for line, like, definitely. But I also think,
at the end, to truly be redeemed, Jeff Bridges has to do a selfless act that does not reward him in any way. And you can argue that him going and getting the Grail to save, mentally heal Robin Williams is an act that actually rewards him, because A, he gets his friend back, but also he feels no longer obliged to Robin Williams for causing the incident with his wife. But the selfless act of saving that man is a true selfless act. He got nothing out of it by making sure that man was saved.
I always viewed that, well, I don't always because I just watched this movie, but I always thought that Robin Williams' character is a king not because he's wealthy, but because he's wealthy in money, but wealthy in knowledge.
Yeah.
And he has this, like, idea about the world. That could also just be me reading into it and just being like, everybody has to fit in a role, you know? And so,
I mean, there's definitely, ironically, that section is put, there were critics at the time who felt that little caper scene at the end to get the Holy Grail was extra and didn't need to be there and just waited the movie, but it actually had to. The whole point of his redemption was doing a selfless act, and that truly was a selfless act. And it also rescued the main character. And it wasn't like this huge, long scene. Like, it was like a 5-minute scene, really quick. Nowadays, if they made it, it'd be like this, the last third
set piece.
Yeah. Last third of the movie would all be about Jeff Bridges breaking into this.
It'd be lowering down, you know, Mission Impossible, style, then he would realize that he's in a moat, and the moat has laser sharks, and then the laser sharks would be trying to eat him, and he would have to fight them off, fist to fang, you know, all the crazy Hollywood stuff.
But I think for me, that scene is actually important for the film because it gives the redemption that Jeff Bridges' character is looking for. He and being the fool, he thinks that his redemption comes through Robin Williams and not the selfless act that he did towards the billionaire. This is one of the few Robin Williams movies we've watched since he's passed. How did you feel about his performance? And how did it resonate with you?
I thought it was a multifaceted performance that allowed fans of his comedy to enjoy it, but also fans of his drama to enjoy it, and for everybody involved to watch something new. Yeah. You know? Because when he first comes on stage and he's all like, taste my arrow, and then, you know, shoots a plunger right into the mean person's private parts, it's like totally him and Hook, you know? And you're like, oh, this is going to be either a rehash or a precursor, I can't remember where Hook lands in his filmography, to Hook. But then that's like the only scene that you can be like, oh, that's a little Robin Williams. You know, this, and he, like, from that point on, it has every twist and turn.
I thought it was very interesting that Terry Gilliam felt that Jeff Bridges grounded the film so he and Robin Williams wouldn't spin out. Because he felt like both of them would start sharing ideas, just popping back and forth, and would have gone in multiple directions, and that Jeff Bridges was the anchor. And so that allowed Robin Williams to be do some inventive stuff and some improv, but always came back to the scene and always was centered in the scene. So when you watch those two work together, I know that people look at Robin Williams' performance because it's the louder of the two. I don't want to say louder doesn't give the isn't fair to the performance, but it's the more
flashier
of the two performances. But the two of them working together was so much fun to watch how they bounced off of each other. And when Jeff Bridges had to go deep in certain scenes, how Robin Williams worked with him, and Mercedes Rule too. Mercedes Rule was amazing in that film. And Amanda Plummer, the two of them were able to be characters. They weren't like two different versions of the same woman. A lot of times in movies like this where there's redemption stories, the female characters aren't that important. And in this story, the female characters are really important. The redemption doesn't happen without them.
No, yes. I also thought it was very interesting because it did talk a little, because it being in a medieval themed movie, I thought it was very noble that they did talk about, you know, courtly love and love from afar. I also thought it was very interesting Mercedes Rule's story line about how she was there for him at his lowest. He abandoned her when he was on his high streak, and he came back when he realized that life is a lot more than just winning. I thought it was very sweet.
Yeah, but it also felt earned. It didn't feel at the end like it was tacked on.
Yeah, it wasn't like, they're getting back together because we need the man to feel better. You know, it was definitely, like you said, I don't think it would have been earned without the Holy Grail scene.
Yeah. And so I think, and I also thought it was very interesting because Mercedes Rule, when I was doing research on this, was talking about how she got a degree in English, and the Fisher King
was her story, like her.
Yeah, it was what she studied, and I was like, oh my god! So she knew a lot about it, but in the performance that she gave, her character was very empathic and understanding, but she wasn't going to take any of the bad behavior from him freely.
Yeah,
one reason why I've always liked her as an actress is she. plays people who are working class or don't seem the most highly educated, but she doesn't play them like they're stupid.
So did you, on our rewatch, did you really enjoy this film?
Yeah, and I was really struck by Robin Williams' performance. There were parts of it that I had forgotten. There was parts of it that his interactions with Amanda Plummer, and her interactions with him. It's very funny. Her body language changes around him, and then when the other people are there, it's like she becomes very stiff around everybody else, and then when she's around him, she's very relaxed. And I thought that was very another characterization that was really, really, really fun to watch. And so I really enjoyed the performances. I really enjoyed the storyline. I can see why when I used to think about this film, I used to think about how it was one of my favorite Terry Gilliam films. I know I'm kind of an outlier. A lot of people think Brazil is his masterpiece. And I enjoy Brazil. I think it's a really well-made film.
Hey, he's continuing to make movies. So who knows? Maybe in 2 years he'll come up with another
film. But I mean, Time Bandits, this one.
Time Bandits is one of my favorites.
Yeah. This film, Fisher King, parts of 12 Monkeys are just amazing. And so, yeah, I have fun watching a lot of his films. So, yeah, the only movie I didn't enjoy of his was Brothers Grimm. That was with
Matt Damon. Is that the movie that they had to, like, because he died, they made two other people play his
part? No, that's the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. And they had, that's the one. But the film that I really didn't enjoy was the Brothers Grimm, which had Matt Damon and Heath Ledger in it. He made that one before, of course. I think the reason I didn't enjoy it is it seemed the most mainstream and least creative of his films. Even the ones, like some of the newer ones that I've watched that are that maybe aren't as awesome. There's still that creative streak in them that makes you go, okay, this is interesting. This is a Terry Gilliam film. And
the Terry Gilliam stamp.
You know? And so, but that one just seemed as if, like, you know, Michael Bay was trying to make a Terry Gilliam film, or Stephen Sommer, who made The Mummy, was trying to make a Terry Gilliam film. So it was kind of like, okay. Yeah. So
I rewatched The Mummy and I was really excited.
I liked the first one. Second one and the third.
I can tolerate the second one. The third one I will not even talk about.
Yeah, the second one that Stephen Sommer made, then he went off and made Van Helsing. Van Helsing, to me, is one of those films that had a great idea that was ruined by somebody who thought story was an exposition was extra. You could totally see that when he was cutting the film, he started cutting out scenes and story that would have explained things. Because there's things that happen and you go, I bet they shot that. People go, oh, it's a badly written film. I bet the screenplay actually had, I bet there was a scene that they shot that he just trimmed to the point where.
5 Scorpion King movies.
Yeah.
And The Rock is only in the first one. Then some other two actors, other actor took his part. He goes, then it's Luke Ferrigno as the Scorpion King's general. It's just crazy. It's the whole The Mummy is crazy, but Brendan Fraser, my main man. Well, I think there's something universal about everybody's love for the Egyptian culture, even if it's just like...
Well, apparently not, because the Tom Cruise version of The Mummy did so badly, Universal decided not to do the Dark Universe.
Yeah, but the thing is, most of the movies, speaking rant here, most of the movie is in New York and London. I don't want Tom Cruise running around New York and New York and London in my pseudo horror film, because guess what? I can just watch Mission Impossible if I want that. What I want is a funny caper in Egypt with a good mummy. If you don't have a good mummy slash a good villain in a horror film, then why are you even making a horror film?
No argument for me. So, all right. So back to the movie at hand, The Fisher King.
Sorry.
No, I know. And we kind of talked about how we really enjoyed watching a Robin Williams movie again. And this movie, to me, this movie was a little bit more poignant because of when I watched, you know, now that he's passed, and how it dealt with mental illness and redemption of mental illness, and how it's always with you. It's like, even though at the end, when he comes out of the coma and he's quote unquote better, he's still doing some of the things that he was doing when he was really ill. So it's like, you know, this is not the end of his journey.
Yeah. A mental health journey is not linear.
Yeah.
It's a lot of things that a lot of people don't understand. I also think this movie is a really good, I think this is a really good movie about love after loss.
Yeah. For both.
You know, loss of a job, loss of a career, loss of your identity versus loss of your wife or your loved one, you know? So I think it's a really good, it's a very sweet.
The core of it is very sweet.
Yes. And it's about friendship. It's about treating people with respect, no matter what social standing they are.
Yeah. It talks about a lot of different things without preaching at you, which was kind of cool.
From the beginning, Jeff Bridges' character hates both rich people and homeless people. By the end, he saves a rich man's life and befriends a homeless man.
Yep. Now that's a character arc.
I really hope that you enjoyed this episode of The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. If you did, please subscribe and leave a cool little review. You can also follow us on Instagram at TML, A Journey Through Cinema, or on Twitter at TML, A Journey, or on Facebook under The Movie Log 1. We also have a website, TMLAJourneyThroughCinema.com. It's very easy to remember. It's just our Instagram handle.com. We hope to see you soon. And if you visit our website, leave a comment.
Or sign up for our newsletter, which is coming soon.
See you next week.
See you next week. Have a great day.